Hi everyone, really excited for today's episode of the Loop podcast. I'm back, which is number one, which is great. After having a few months off while I had my baby, and I'm really excited for my first guest being back on the podcast. We're here with Georgiana Laudy, who's co-founder and author of Forget the Funnel. Today we're going to talk about all about prioritizing a customer-led approach, which, as you are all listeners of all of the Cognizant content, you'll know we're big fans of here. And we also are very strong advocates of the whole idea that the funnel is a thing of the past. So really excited to dive into this with Gia and get into the details. So I guess to give our listeners some context, it would be great if you could give us some background on yourself, how you met your co-founder and co-author, and also why you decided to write this book together.
Yes. Well, first, thanks for having me and congratulations and welcome back. So background on me, I guess the depends on how far back you want to go. I've been in some way, shape or form marketing for the past, it's 2024. So since about 2000 is when I really started in this like digital marketing space. In about 2011, actually, as I started to get introduced, Twitter, RIP, really did introduce me, that's right, to the sort of the tech scene. And so I really got into more marketing for technology companies, and I was exposed to the SaaS sort of space and business model in the tech scene. And I sort of fell in love with it. And that was in the, maybe 2009, 2010, 2011-ish. And I kind of never looked back because I noticed that there was finally an industry, especially recurring revenue businesses like SaaS, that really marketing played a really pivotal role, not just in, you know, post-acquisition marketing, but in revenue generation overall. And so I was really excited to sort of jump on there, and because marketing has such a critical role to play in like company growth at recurring revenue businesses and in tech. So that's when I sort of started, I shifted from just more general digital marketing into really B2B SaaS. And then I was in-house for a little while. I was freelancing for a little while. And when I left my in-house role, I synced up with Claire, who was also leaving her in-house role. So I was a VP of marketing and she was a director of marketing at Unbounce and at Calendly. And we decided to launch a sort of just a content project together called Forget the Funnel, really geared towards those marketers working inside of tech environments that were, you know, looking to think more strategically, were, you know, pretty typically undervalued, underpaid, and expectations very, very high. So we really cared a lot about that group because we, you know, lived that ourselves. And so that's how Forget the Funnel sort of came to be. As we were running this content series together, we began to learn more about each other's sort of backgrounds and philosophies. And Claire has a deep background in like customer research and jobs to be done and like user behavior and user onboarding and things like that. I had a little bit more like operational and strategic background, kind of like holistic marketing. And we married those two things together when we started working with some companies that needed both. We started working on a couple of projects together, and then we eventually came up with this framework, which we called customer-led growth, which is basically about pulling critical customer insights from your customers and then operationalizing those insights across the customer experience so the team is mobilized, to be really, really effective and to increase conversions and to, help customers get from one milestone to the next. So it really, I mean, it's a long history, but it came sort of by this like need that we recognized in the market. And we've been working with companies under the sort of consultancy of Forget the Funnel for the past 5 years. And it's been really, really fun and lots of stories to tell.
And what would be your sweet spot in terms of the companies that you're working with? Like, what did they look like? What's their makeup?
So generally, we work with companies who, like I mentioned already, so B2B SaaS. I tread lightly here because I we don't have a hard line of companies that we work with or the right size of company that we work with, other than companies with happily paying customers. If you have happily paying customers, you can lean into those customers and insight about those customers to get you more of the same types of customers. So we basically work with companies to help them more, understand their best customers a lot better, and then operationalize that experience and make decisions, much more informed decisions versus like the guesswork that a lot of marketing teams are, sort of forced into. And so, I would say, so the can B2B SaaS.
I'm just going to dig in, and I'm also going to go off. Really interested in this, just because it's really applicable to us at the moment and kind of project that we're undergoing. But I'd really love to understand. So when you say you are trying to operationalize like what happily paying customers and the insights that you can get from those, mm-hmm. For your, the companies that you're working for, like how do you do that? I mean, I think one of the things that I'm acutely aware of is there's a lot of different mechanisms, and there's a lot of different software and tools, and whether it's quantitative or qualitative data that you can go out and get. How do you put a framework around that and like make that repeatable and scalable?
It's a great question. And that's really why we came up with this framework, was to answer exactly that. So there's lots of different types of research, as you mentioned. There's this sort of continuous sort of micro type of research, and then there's more macro style research, which is a little bit more focused on like business goals. And that's the type of research that we focus on as a foundation to establish that foundational understanding. And then we usually advocate for layering on top of that other types of like quant research. So we definitely lean into the qualitative side. And how we do that is we work with companies to identify the group of customers within their existing customer base that represents the group of customers that they want more of. So one of the first questions we often get asked when we talk about the way that we work with companies is like, well, what about the company? What about the customers we didn't get, or our churned customers, or things like that? And those can be very, very valuable customers or lost customers to learn from, but they don't set the stage for that foundational understanding that needs to be in place first. So we typically will recommend starting with like, identify who are those customers that you want more of. If you could clone these customers, like who would they be? How would you sort of identify them within your customer base? Sometimes we work with companies where there's hundreds of thousands of customers. And so we've got a big pool of customers, and we work with the companies that we work with, the teams that we work with, to figure out who is that subset of those customers that really represent like high LTV and high retention. They were easy to acquire. These are the customers that are a joy to serve. They implicitly understand the value that you provide. They have a high willingness to pay. They're the customers that you serve the best and get the most amount of sort of value. So we work with companies to understand like who is that subset of customers. And then from that subset of customers, by the way, there's the flip side of that. I painted a picture of like companies with, lower ACV, hundreds of thousands of customers. Obviously the opposite end of that spectrum is if you're in an enterprise space and you have a few dozen customers, then really understanding who in that sort of book of business represent the customers that you want more of. Those customers are where you start, because if you can understand those customers, then all other types of research or understanding or decisions and quant data can be layered on top of that foundational understanding of who do we serve best? Who is it that has a real urgent problem that we solve? What is the context in which those people have, first experienced the need for a solution like ours? Where do they go to solve that? What previous solution are they struggling with? Who do they talk to make decisions? What really motivates them to choose us over all of the other, possible solutions available to them? What is it about our solution that convinces them that we're the right one for them? What can they do now that they weren't able to do before? Really understanding, we use the jobs to be done sort of methodology to guide this type of research. So really understanding what your customers are hiring your solution to solve for them and do for them is that foundational understanding that has to be in place before you layer on other style of research.
Out of interest, the output of that, like What is it? What's the takeaway from it? And then how is that, I guess, socialized within the organization so that it's like, yeah, it's something that everyone kind of lives and breathes and yeah, everyone is aligned around the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what the framework was built to do. It's exactly that. So the jobs to be done approach to running research, what it does basically is like you have these conversations with maybe 10 to 12 customers. Now, if you're in a situation where you've got hundreds of thousands of customers, you'd probably want to start with like qualitative style surveys first to pre-qualify, get your list down, and then you do outreach to actually have one-on-one conversations. You run customer interviews. From those customer interviews, you can then identify those patterns across all of these customers and identify the jobs to be done that exist within these ideal customers. So if you can identify those jobs to be done, sometimes there's almost never one. Sometimes there's two or three or four different jobs to be done among these amazing customers of yours. And then you have a decision to make. Do you want to serve all of them? Is there one of them that you want to sort of disqualify and maybe, you know, not pay as much attention to? Is there one you really want to lean into that you feel, you know, represents a big opportunity in the future, or that you provide a ton of value to today because you're really looking for, you know, closer sort of revenue opportunities? So you may have to, there's a decision to make that we, you know, would work through with the companies that we work with to help them identify and prioritize. Once we've made that prioritization, what we do is we take the voice of customer from those conversations, because we've organized it through all of these different dimensions, like previous solution, the context in which they, you know, experience that pain, all of those different dimensions that we understand from them. And I have seen all those patterns across. And then we basically map it against that customer's experience. So we look to, you know, what they're struggling with previously, how they make decisions, what their watering holes are, all the way through to how they first experience the product, when they reach, you know, first value, when they reach product engagement, continued value, value growth. And we map that out across a customer experience map in terms of like what ideal, what good looks like for those customers. And then we've got a customer experience map with milestones. So the customer experience map breaks that down into three phases: the struggle phase, the evaluation, and the growth phase. Each of those phases are further broken down into different milestones depending on your solution. For each of those milestones, we identify a KPI. Once we have that customer experience map, then what we do is we look at the existing customer experience and we see all of the ways that the existing customer experience is out of alignment with that ideal. And generally, positioning and messaging, pretty well every single time we've worked with a company, messaging needs to be analyzed and updated. Very often the early customer experience, so that early product experience, the product engagement itself, and then often where things get really fun is that continued value and identifying all the ways that companies could be helping their customers get more value from their product and you know, turn into sort of a revenue monetization opportunity in the growth phase. So hopefully that answers your question at a high level. Happy to drill in wherever.
Yeah, no, I think pretty super useful, very interesting, especially because we're kind of undergoing bit of a project at the moment. So I think
we are, yeah.
Taking a step back, I guess just from a philosophical perspective, I think it sounds like it's like the way that you think about how we need to go to market today is quite aligned to the way that we think about things at Cognizant. And it's definitely a movement that we're seeing in the B2B SaaS space as well, which is this kind of move away from what we were taught in marketing school, which is like the funnel and that people buy for a funnel. And now we realize that that is absolutely not the way that people buy, and that we really need to adapt our marketing so that we can actually better reach and influence them. Just would love to understand like your general philosophy around this, and how that's kind of evolved under this product-led approach that you, that you spearhead.
Yeah. So there's a lot in that question that you just asked. Philosophy wise, I would say where it started was one of the first sort of origin stories of this framework that we use was my experience at Airbnb back in, I believe it was 2013. And I was in house I was working, I was a VP of marketing, working for a very quickly growing B2B SaaS. We were very much marketing led. So the company was looking to marketing to bring in like more leads. When I say more leads, I see that like that meme with the screaming like person, like it's all about more leads. Like new trial signups were like the name of the game for us. And that's not to say that the product wasn't, you know, sticky, that our customers weren't happy. But when it came to growth, it was really marketing that the company looked for. And that was very typical at the time. It's still often typical too, where different investors, like if you have any sort of outside investment, or a lot of investors or board members, or they'll be looking to growth basically on the front end, on the acquisition side, to see that there's demand in the market. So many B2B SaaS companies are forced to sort of inflate their acquisition numbers in order to show that upwards trajectory of growth in order to impress the board and investors, raise capital, things like that. So it's still true today, but it is far less, which is why many companies are like yours, where they're like, you know what, it's time to get smarter about our customer experience. It's time to work more smarter and more efficiently versus just, you know, throwing more at the top of the funnel, so to speak, and doing more with what we have. And so the experience that I had was basically operating like a chicken with my head cut off, like trying to, you know, impress the team, trying to hit all my goals and targets, sort of operating in this way. And that Airbnb experience was basically me visiting the Airbnb office, like headquarters in San Francisco, and seeing their customer journey map basically taped to the wall. And it was nothing like the site, you know, customer life cycles with MQLs and SQLs. It was nothing like a funnel. It wasn't even like pirate metrics, which had, you know, recently sort of become more popularized. It was really centered around the customer getting value. And a light bulb went off for me. And so when we got back to, you know, back to the office, the head of customer success, myself, head of marketing, and our co-founder and head of product built a customer journey map, which essentially centered around customer value moments. Then fast forward a couple of years later, I meet Claire. We start talking about the jobs to be done methodology and realize that we didn't have to lock ourselves in a room to make decisions about what our customer's experience would be. We didn't have to guess or hypothesize or test quite as much as we did. There's actually methodologies to run customer research to really inform what that customer experience should be. And so we sort of married these two frameworks together and called it customer-led growth, because it really is focused around, you know, if we can deliver value to customers, if we can help customers achieve their goals, then the business will achieve its goals. And so combining those two things together is really the sort of philosophy that wraps around customer-led growth. Hopefully that answers your question. I know there was more to it.
No, I think you touched on the two core elements. Okay. That's great. And actually it's on the next question, so we'll just skip straight through that. But yeah. I think, you've spoken a bit about this, like when you were talking through the example of how you go about doing the research and getting like the output of the work that you do with these organizations. But I guess when it comes to actually like operationalizing those insights to inform mm-hmm. decisions that mm-hmm. you then generate growth, like there's a framework, which is great, but how are successful organizations like doing that? And then I guess follow up question to that is like, how often does that need to be revisited and re-optimized? Is there a special formula to that?
That's a great question.
I'll stick there.
Yeah. Okay. So I heard two different questions in there. One is like, okay, but brass tacks, how do you actually do this thing? And then the other question is, how often should a company be, you know, running through this type of exercise? Okay. So I'll answer the first one first, which is, so that process that I described of mapping the customer experience, identifying these milestones and these KPIs, the sort of brass tacks way that we do this with companies is we get the major decision makers in a room to basically show them where that ideal customer experience is out of alignment with the existing customer experience. And so we use like a whiteboarding tool for this, and we have the customer experience map, the ideal customer experience in one view. And then we have the existing customer experience, every little micro engagement of the existing customer experience basically laid out so that we can analyze the ways that they're out of alignment. Now, as a team, we do this on our side. We do run through the process for how to do this in our book, but essentially it's analyzing milestone by milestone all of the ways that you might be sort of dropping the ball, so to speak, or that you're out of alignment. So one of the things that we didn't talk about and we didn't really drill into, but in the research, for example, if you think about the response to the question, like, what was the moment that you realized that our solution was the right one, that it was going to solve your problem? Imagine what the answers to that question yields the team in terms of insight into what that early customer experience should look like. So all of those answers, we've got all of that insight now. Not only do we have the insight, we've got the voice of customer. And we have those themes where we can say, okay, here's what really matters to these customers. And here's how we can map that to the specific parts of the product or product attributes or solution attributes that deliver that value. And we do what we call value mapping, essentially. And when we do that value mapping, it makes it much more straightforward what part of our solution to introduce in what order and using which words. Mm-hmm. And so if we have that, then we can look at the existing customer experience, like I said, and see all the ways that it's out of alignment. So with our process, we do a half day workshop where we sit down with teams and we say, look, you're dropping the ball here. You're doing great here. This is something you're not doing. They might want to consider. We basically identify all of the opportunities at every single one of these milestones. And then we work with teams to figure out what's on the product roadmap, because that's huge, right? What is already in play that we may have an opportunity to influence because it's already in play. Because everybody, you know, as this research is going on, work is happening.
Yeah.
So what's already in play? And then where is there an opportunity where we're actually hurting conversions that we could swap out for a better experience, and we help them prioritize. Okay, now that's the nitty gritty of like the how to is a bunch of background work and then a half day workshop with the stakeholders basically that are impacted by all of this work, which generally, by the way, head of marketing, head of sales, head of customer success, head of product for sure. And then sometimes it's a CEO. Oftentimes it would be a CEO, sometimes a CTO, depending on, you know, the company setup. Okay. And then the answer to your other question, is it depends. So the question being, how often do you need to do this type of work? So oftentimes when we hear from companies, it's because they're tired of not getting the signups they know they should be getting. So sometimes it's acquisition has slowed or become inconsistent in some way and not really sure why. We know we could be doing a better job. We know we could be acquiring more customers. We know we should be getting more for the marketing we're already investing. And so in that situation, it's, you know, there's absolutely an opportunity. Another thing that often happens is there's new movers, like the market has changed, or there's new competitors that have come up in the space. And so the market has shifted in a way where the company needs to rethink its approach, either in messaging and positioning, or sometimes in their go-to-market strategy overall. And then another, instance where it would be obvious is if the product is making a major shift, and the company basically needs to recognize that there's a, I don't want to use the word pivot, but that there's like a pivot in the direction of the value that the product provides in the market. And there's a rethinking that's needed. Another thing that very, very often happens, which might be resonate with you and some of the listeners, is companies who have been predominantly sales-led that want to start leveraging their product more for acquisition. So introducing more product-led kind of opportunities. When you want to go one-to-many programmatic, product-led, this type of exercise is wildly valuable, because this is where you're going to identify all the opportunities. You can still stay, high converting, but at scale. Because you can deliver experiences that really resonate and that actually land versus relying on a one-to-one relationship to carry a customer from like demo through to like full engagement. So product, going from sales-led to product-led is another time. Other than that, I would say major shifts in the market happen periodically. I typically recommend annually, like if everything else is equal, then I would say annually. I've seen companies do it more often, but annually is about where you'd want to be as you're reevaluating the opportunities for the next year. Like we should be improving our onboarding rates, or we need to be improving our retention rates, or we should be, you know, we want to increase our expansion or monetization opportunities. Anytime you're sort of reevaluating something that you know that customer insight could inform versus, again, hypothesizing or guessing, which is the long way to go about it.
Amazing. And then in terms of like where you've seen companies successfully execute on the back of this exercise, so you've identified the gaps, you've said this is where we've got opportunity to improve. I guess then the work is the start. It's like there's a project, people are assigned tasks. What generally, I guess, enables successful implementation, and where do companies fall down?
Great question. So what enables implementation is definitely the customer experience map itself and making sure that any programs or assets that are updated, that the measure of success of those assets roll up to the KPI within that milestone. So it's staying very focused on where the sort of boundaries are and trying not to do everything with one asset, for example. So what might be an example of this? So let's say the first value milestone, like the beginning of the evaluation phase, generally is about getting somebody to first value as efficiently as possible. And so you might want to focus on the sign up experience or the product onboarding or emails that are being sent in that early product experience. And so the thing to keep in mind there is that you're not trying to get product engagement. You're not trying to get continued value here. You're really focusing on helping customers get to just that first moment of value. So remaining focused on what that first value KPI is really important. Where I see teams go wrong is they try to do everything all at once. And so they're like, oh no, we're not only going to help customers get to, you know, product activation, but we're also going to help them get to engagement and, a habit all with one email series. And like, no, do not do that. That's too much to ask. You're throwing the kitchen sink at your customers. That's where most teams go wrong, is throwing the kitchen sink, because we're all excited about our offering, right? We think that we're like the best thing since sliced bread, but really our customers have very specific needs and things that they're looking for. And so being sort of tempered in how you introduce the product is where I would say I see a lot of teams go wrong. The other thing that I see teams do, unfortunately, is overwhelm with unrelated things, like follow us on LinkedIn, and we've got this podcast, and oh, there's this webinar happening, and like they haven't even signed up yet. And these webinars are actually for more centered around, you know, helping customers be successful. So really bearing in mind what that experience is for customers within each of these milestones and protecting them from anything else, I think is kind of the best thing to help teams, enable teams to build more higher converting experiences, but also protect customers from things that are irrelevant. I think that's probably the biggest culprit.
Amazing. That makes sense. And actually, I'm going to slightly follow on from this, because I just noticed that you had held a community role before. I realize it's back in the day, but I'm really interested how you feel, because there's a movement now, definitely, and especially in B2B SaaS space, for this idea of community-led growth, and especially when you talk about protecting the customer within the value, like the point of value that they're in right now, and that message. How do you feel that community either helps, hinders, or plays into this strategy?
What are your goals for the community?
I think as a go-to-market enabler.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So if it is, because I've seen a lot of companies be really successful with community when the goals of the community are around retention and expansion. So, you know, customer education and things like that. They can be really, really effective. I was just reminded of this stat that Prodpad, I can't remember what years this was. I want to say it was 2020, or maybe it was 2019. They launched a community, and 99% of their cancellations came from 99% of their cancellations came from people outside of their community. So their community was wildly effective for delivering continued value to their customer base and helping with expansion and things like that. So on the flip side of things, how would I think about community being used as like a go-to-market or an acquisition tool? I guess really it depends on your customers. So, and that's always going to be the answer, by the way, is it depends what's more relevant, what's the most relevant experience for your customers. So we could talk about maybe an example. Do you maybe want to give me an example of customers, and then we could sort of
So let's say I can give an example of we see it now, like so sales and marketing. I'm a member of like various communities for sales and marketing leaders, or just sales and marketing individuals, I guess. And it is definitely being used by those technology companies as what they would believe to be a low cost acquisition mechanism. And
there's nothing low cost about running a community.
and they call it this sort of community led growth. That's this new kind of phrase that's been coined.
Right.
And I'm just interested because I feel like, for example, I'm part of these communities a lot of the time, and I don't really have a clue what the software is
that's a problem.
And then I'm trying to marry up like what they're trying to achieve with the community with this point, which I think is super valuable, which is like protect a customer for the point in the journey and their experience that they need, like that consistent message for that moment in time. And I'm just trying to marry up the idea that like you could have a community which is going to probably have a ton of content being thrown at these people, and then also do that same thing. So I just don't know if they can go together, or like, yeah, how that could work.
It can. I mean, I've seen companies do a decent job of it, but I shouldn't even say decent. I've seen companies do a really good job of it. You have to do a really good job of it. You can't have a mediocre community. It's too expensive to run a mediocre community. And by the way, community-led growth, I think of community-led growth as post-acquisition. I think of community-led growth as being around retention and expansion and providing value to your customers. So they would never, ever in a million years want to consider leaving because they get so much value out of not only your solution, but the community that's surrounded that solution. So that's how I think of
there would have to be a mechanism by which they have to exit the community on exiting being your customer. Like it's like a gate.
That's right.
Yeah. Which I don't think, I haven't seen that really be the case.
Anyway. Look, it might not be that might not be a necessary component. That's a detail that I think, you know, people could make depending on what their strategy is. But generally, I think of communities as being particularly valuable for providing the existing customer base with the opportunity to level up, be more successful, and also support newer customers in their journey and build. I mean, that's what community is. It's not the team, the technology company to the community. That's not the setup. A community is about having customers support other customers. Now that can be helpful in potentially, you know, where there is a, I don't want to introduce a whole other term here, but like a kind of a marketplace where you've got two different types of customers, one in a sort of service provider scenario that might be motivated to helping early customers be successful because there's a potential opportunity there. And we have seen that. But that's not really what you're describing. You're describing a community that's actually built for acquisition purposes. And in that case, those companies cannot build that community up as being like, I was going to pick a brand, but I don't want to pick on anybody. But you don't rally a community around a piece of tech. You rally a community around a philosophy or a set of values or belief system. And that shared belief system is that space for that community to sort of rally. It's not about the technology necessarily.
I think this has actually been quite very useful. I'm just in my thought process around community, because it comes back to like, why go back to that place? Mm-hmm. Like, where is the community living and why do people come back to it? Because I think communities live and die by the fact that people just don't go back there. I mean, totally. I don't know how many Slack communities, but if it's the place where you go to be more successful mm-hmm. in the jobs to be done that you need to do, which is also technology is serving. And then, so it's like both enabling you to like be really successful customer, but also mm-hmm. that's why you go back. Then it makes a lot of sense. So I think where we've been trying to think about community, it's like, but why do they go back? Like, and I think I see on the acquisition community piece, that is the piece that a lot of the time is missing, because it's like, well, there is no real tie, I guess, beyond just consistently delivering value. And that's really tough to do.
Yes. And I think good call on bringing it back to the job to be done, because you have to be focused around that. And there might be, when you do this type of foundational research that we were describing before, when you do that type of research and you have that level of understanding about the context that people are in before they experience the need or they, you know, feel that struggle where they need to solve a problem that you can help them solve, having that context, if you're leveraging a community for acquisition and awareness and acquisition, that's the world in which you need to embed yourself, right? In that context, in that struggle, in that old way, in that anxieties and habits that precede somebody needing a solution like yours, and then eventually, getting value from your solution. So putting your head in that context, if you can make a community work in there, great. But it's that context that is like critically important, because if you build a community that is too generalized and isn't focused on that problem being solved or customers or potential customers with that job to be done, you are just managing a community for the sake of managing a community, and it is not actually going to yield the acquisition numbers or the activation numbers or the retention numbers that you know, we're looking for in the community. It can be really effective. I tend to lean more for community-led growth on the customer side of things versus the acquisition side of things.
Yeah, amazing. That's actually been so like very interesting from a personal perspective as well. So Thank you.
I don't get to talk about community a lot, so that was interesting.
Yeah, I know. I don't know how I've managed to go from like customer-led to community-led, but you know, I'm just basically making this podcast all about me, and I hope everyone finds it really interesting at the same time. One question that we always end our podcast on, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, is if you could tell marketers today, like, what's one thing that you would get them to start doing, one thing you'd tell them to stop doing?
Start doing and stop. Well, I mean, they're pretty related. So start doing, I think, if you believe that the answers to your marketing and growth questions are likely to live inside the heads of your best customers, then what I would advocate to start doing is to take baby steps in terms of validating that and proving that to your leadership team and maybe adjacent team members, and get people excited about what can be learned. One of the lowest hanging fruit opportunities to do that is to add a simple question to, this is really tactical, adding a simple question to your signup, even if it's to a demo request or free to sign up or trial, that is basically an open text field, which is like, what was it that was going on in your world that led you to sign up for our X today? Open text field. Just that, you don't even have to do anything with it. Just start capturing this information. And just the answer to that question is going to give you a ton more insight into who are you attracting through the front door, but also just as critically, in fact, probably more critically, who are you sending into your product? And what is that experience that they're going to get on the other side of your website? And is either one of those out of alignment? And it'll give you a ton of insight. And that's a great sort of baby way of introducing customer research, like qualitative customer research, to get folks excited about what else can we learn from these customers? What else might we be able to optimize? Because we all know that filling a leaky bucket is an absolute waste of time. And in this economy, nobody can afford to do that anymore. And so if you're, you know, running sort of guesswork, and you're A/B testing landing pages, and you're doing this, all this type of, you know, experimentation and running campaigns and seeing if they work, you're wasting a lot of time you don't actually need to be wasting. Mm-hmm. You can get a straight answer, and you can be making decisions a lot more confidently, armed with, you know, voice of customer, armed with, you know, value mapping, intel, and things like that. So it's always going to be, if you do the math, that's the other thing that I say is do the math on, if you improved your onboarding rates, how much more is that worth to the business than if you drove more traffic? You will always get a higher ROI out of improving your onboarding rates or your demo close rate or whatever than you will by driving more traffic. So I tout a lot less marketing at more customers with sometimes less marketing.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And then stop, I guess they're tied together, guesswork. But I'm just
tied. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Well, it's been really, really fun chatting to you. And I guess for everyone who'd like to learn more, because I feel like I'm definitely going to be going out and buying the book, it's Forget the Funnel, and definitely worth going and hearing more about how to start your customer-led approach at your company. And I suppose otherwise they can get in touch with you LinkedIn, best way, or
LinkedIn. Yep, absolutely.
Amazing.
Trying to be as active as I can over there. Yes.
Building that community. Amazing. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking to you. And
yeah, you too.
Yeah. And thank you.